It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. You know what the melting eyes of a puppy do to you? Well, that's what a hive of bees did to our guest. She fell in love. Journalist Holly Bishop turned beekeeper when she tasted her first hive honey and realized bees have personalities. She ended up writing Robbing the Bees, a biography of honey. Well, the Stearns have found the Tiffany Jewels of Donuts at Top Pot Donuts in Seattle. Wine maverick Josh Wesson talks the unsung and bargain-priced whites of France. Then it's bottled water. What's in a bottle of H2O that's worth $3? New York Times reporter Julia Moskin reports. And it's an adventure on a tank of gas. A Seattle food editor has three great day trips. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Thank you. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Today, it's the wonder and biology of honey and the bees who make it. The story is told by journalist and beekeeper Holly Bishop. She's author of Robbing the Bees, A Biography of Honey. Good cheap wine is our goal. And wine maverick Josh Wesson makes it happen with his new collection of France's unsung whites. Now, on the opposing side of cheap drinks, I ask, why are we spending $9 billion a year on what comes out of the tap for free? We look at the bottled water conundrum with New York Times reporter Julia Moskin. Adventures that you can have on a tank of gas. Seattle is base camp, and a local food editor has three dynamite day trips. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Now, you can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
You know, occasionally, Lynn, Michael and I travel around the country and we get so enthused about something, usually a piece of food, that we actually consider leaving and moving from Connecticut to be near this food. And it doesn't happen very often, but it just happened in Seattle, Washington, where we were taken by somebody who knows a lot about the area to a place called Top Pot Donuts. And being a donut aficionado, I can tell you these were the best donuts I ever had in my life. And there were thoughts that went through my head of actually moving to Seattle just so I could have a donut every morning.
This is not a bad place to live under any circumstances. But where is Top Pot? Is it near the market?
There are three Top Pots around town. And the one we went to is just a gorgeous place with book-lined walls. I mean, it doesn't look like a donut shop at all. But, of course, the important thing is the donut itself. And more important specifically is the crunch of the skin of the donut when you bite into it.
I never thought of donuts having skin.
No, there's a crunch. You crunch through the exterior and get to the cakey part. You know, this is a creamy, cakey inside that is nothing like those puffy, you know, Krispy Kremes.
Yeah, that's the thing. There are two types of donuts. There's the, you know, kind of greasy ones, and then there's the old-fashioned cake donuts, and these are the old-fashioned cake donuts. But not only is the donut so good, but the chocolate glazes and the espresso chocolate and the strawberry buttercream. They had maple, which was to die for. Coconut. I mean, not as many choices as one of the franchise donut places, but they don't need that many. I mean, there maybe were 10, a dozen types of donuts. And it was so hard for me to get pulled away from the maple and the chocolate to even think of eating anything else.
So do they do more than donuts?
There may be some other pastries on the menu, but it's fundamentally a donut and coffee place. And when I say coffee, this is Seattle-level coffee. I mean, really good coffee, which what more do you want with donuts?
It was just one of those perfect morning experiences that Michael and I replicated for, I think, four mornings because we were there for 4 days. And maybe we went back in the afternoon, but we just kept having coffee and donuts, coffee and donuts, coffee and donuts. And the more we had, the more sort of it just seemed a smart idea to move 3,000 miles from where we live so we could have the donuts.
So what are the stores like?
Well, they're very clean, modern, sort of blonde wood books on the shelves. Charming, but also kind of a Scandinavian look to them. They're not the usual road food dive that Michael and I like, but they're also not so fancy schmancy that, you know, I mean, how fancy schmancy could a donut place be?
Well, is this a new business then?
It's fairly new. I think it opened within the last year or so. And actually, Rebecca Den, who is the food writer for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, is the person who took us there. And she was the one who said, I know you guys like donuts, and I know you guys think that the best donuts are in the Northeast, which we used to. And she said, let me take you to Top Pot and change your mind. And of course, we were extremely skeptical, but our minds were changed.
Well, thanks, guys. You're welcome, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Donuts, donuts, hi, diddle-diddle, and I'm wondering if I can find me some nice round donuts, the ones with the hole in the middle. Donuts.
Jane and Michael donuts. Stern are authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, check out our free weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Every week, we send you a new recipe designed to make your work-night suppers a little easier. And we also do a weekly podcast, Kitchen Questions. You'll find it all, oh, and so much more, on the website. SplendidTable.org. It wasn't enough for Josh Wesson to win awards as a sommelier or to co-author a now cult book, Red Wine with Fish. No, Josh had one of those paradigm shifts. He turned his back on bottles priced in three figures. Instead, he took up a greater challenge, tracking down exceptional sipping for modest money for his bestsellers wine shops and for us. Hey, Josh, good to have you back.
I love being here.
You know, Josh, I've really gone very contrarian. While everybody else orders red wine, I'm getting into whites and not necessarily always the Chardonnays or the Sauvignon Blancs. What have you got in terms of whites that maybe I haven't tasted yet, some new ones to try?
Well, you know, I think the next little thing in white wines is going to come from good old France. There's a raft of unsung heroes there, white wines that either were famous once and are now overlooked, or never got famous but should be because they're so delicious and offer great values. And for sipping when the weather's a little bit warmer, you know, the wines that I'm going to mention are all just delicious with or without food and not too expensive. And they're fun. They're fun because they come from wildly different places, made from different grapes, but the thread that binds them together is that they're just lip-smacking, never aged in wood, not serious, they're not neurotic, they're just exactly the kinds of wine. They're like
not
you.
Overwrought, yet not frivolous, yes.
They flatter you, then.
Okay, name some names.
Well, you know, the Languedoc is down towards the border of Spain, and even though they're famous for reds, they do make a couple of whites. My most favorite is made from a grape called Picpoul d'Épinay. And it's this little lip stinger of a white wine. It's juicy and fresh and has these back notes of citrus. You know, it's like a lemon squirt of acidity with a little bit of citrusy complexity. I mean, the wines aren't totally simple, but they're really bright and really appealing. And just, you know, if you're bored with drinking Muscadet with oysters, this is, you know, the greatest sub you could ever find. Picpoul d'Épinay, Bouillon makes a wonderful one from the Coteau de Languedoc. It sells for about $10. Comes in this great bottle that when you're ready to give up your, you know, Matus and Lancers candle holder.
Yes,
You can just use this as a candle. It's really gorgeous. Looks like a bowling pin, and it's just wonderful. Wonderful to seafood.
Another one?
Sure. Sauvignon de Touraine. You know, it's up in the Loire, and everybody in the Loire talks about the famous Loire wines of Vouvray, which are wonderful.
Right, and Sancerre, which is another one.
And Sancerre and Pouilly-Fumé. And Sancerre and Pouilly-Fumé are made from Sauvignon Blanc, which is the exact same grape that goes into this Sauvignon de Touraine. And the difference is you don't have to pay for the name Sancerre or Pouilly-Fumé, so you're getting a Sancerre in a junior achiever version. It's like and it comes with almost all the deliciousness of a beautiful Sancerre or Puy-Fumé. This one that I'm recommending is called Domaine Clos Roche Blanche. And it tastes of the soil, and it tastes of the sun, and it tastes of limes and grapefruit. And it's just wonderful fun to drink with goat cheese, with vinaigrette dressed salads. It'll cut through any fish that's a little bit oily. It's just wonderful on its own. You just put a straw in the bottle. Fantastic junior achiever version of Sancerre at half the price. $12-13 will get you a very stylish glass of Sauvignon from the Loire.
What about the Bordeaux area? Because you've got the Graves whites that come out of there and the great sweet wines that come out of Chateau Yquem. Any whites that would fall into your category here?
You know, if you look a little bit left or right of the bullseye of Bordeaux, and in this case Graves, where most of the great white wines of Bordeaux come from, you're going to end up wading across a river into the region of Entre-deux-Mers. Now, Entre-deux-Mers is one of those French terms. It means between the two seas.
Yeah.
But it's not really seas. It's rivers. It's the Dordogne and the Garonne. And in between these two rivers is this patch of land where they make incredibly good white Bordeaux. And the same grapes that go into Graves go into these white wines. That's Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon and a little bit of Muscadel. And they're just so much fun to drink. They taste of the soil. They can be quite complex. They're wonderful with river fish. They're great with a wide range of cheeses. And one of my favorites is also one of the least expensive that I've found around the country. It's called Chateau Bonnet. And it sells for $11 or $12. And you know, you could close your eyes and think you're in Graves. It's that good.
One more, Josh.
Let's go to a place that people can't even spell, the Savoie region. It's not terribly far from Geneva. If you were sort of in Geneva and you faced west and started walking, you'd more or less get into the Savoie. And they grow grapes there that you don't find anywhere else in France. There's a local variety called Jacquer, and it's the grape that feeds the most famous white wine of the Savoie, which is Apremont. And this wine is just, I mean, it was made for quiche Lorraine. It was made for picnics. It's made from this grape that most people have never heard of. It's a new flavor profile for them. It's quite different from Chardonnay or Sauvignon Blanc or Riesling, some of the other white grapes that people may be more familiar with. And it's very, very fragrant. And it's just lovely to drink. It can't help but turn you into a white wine lover if you have a glass of this on a summer day.
Well, you've given me new territory to explore. Hey, Josh, thanks.
Start walking, baby.
Wine Authority Joshua Wesson is co-creator of Best Sellers Wine Shops. Now, Josh's picks of unsung French whites, well, you know where they are. They're on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, fresh cheese season is in high gear, and those whites are naturals with fresh goat and sheep cheeses. Now, check out some local cheese sources. Cheesemakers are coming up faster than mushrooms after a rain. Now, you can do a salad with this, and it can be a main dish. Now, what you want is as many different kinds of greens as you can find. You want some sweet melon, onion, toasted walnuts, then that creamy cheese. And now the dressing has to be wine friendly, so do some Dijon mustard with cream and fresh herbs. Now the recipe, I actually did it, French greens and melon salad with fresh goat cheese, well, it's on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, robbing the bees and bottled water, sugar daddy or savior. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at target.com/supertarget. Holly Bishop was minding her own business, working in New York City with a little country place in Connecticut. One day, a beekeeping friend formally introduced Holly to a hive of bees, and the earth moved. Holly was in love. She became a beekeeper and a helpless researcher. She couldn't resist tracking every bee-related tidbit that came her way. Well, finally, a framework appeared. Bees and honey from every angle. Science, economics, and history. Her book is Robbing the Bees, a biography of honey, the sweet liquid gold that seduced the world. Holly, welcome.
Thank you.
You know, you talk about bees the way a dog lover talks about their favorite dog. I mean, what drew you to bees?
I was thinking about that yesterday because I went out to visit my bees. And here in New England, it's been really muggy and hot and rainy. And I went up to the hives and all the bees were basically hanging out on the front stoop. They were crawling up the front of the hive just to get out of all that moisture. Imagine how just humid and disgusting it is in the hive. And they reminded me like of a dog just lying down under a tree on a hot day. So they do have a personality. They respond, you know, the way a pet would to a visit from their owner or a hot day or a cold bath.
This may seem like a dumb question, but what exactly is honey?
I think that's a great question. I've been talking about this book for the past year, and this is a question that people are sort of always sheepishly afraid to ask me, but it's a really good question. And honey is plant nectar. It's that sweet sort of sugar water you find in a flower blossom. And bees collect it, like just tastes at a time, and bring it back to the hive. I think it takes 2 million visits to flowers to make 1 pound of honey. So they take these tiny little whiffs of sugar water back to the hive and essentially dry it and cure it and turn it into honey.
And they bring it back, what, it's attached to their legs? They sip it?
They sip it. They have a little stomach for that purpose, and they add a bit of enzyme to it in the stomach, and then when they bring it back to the hive, that enzyme helps the conversion to honey.
How does it go from being a watery consistency to being that thick, viscous honey?
Well, it starts out, the nectar is about 80% water. And then through that enzyme that I mentioned and just drying and heat, because honey is usually made in summer, so just good old summer heat and ventilation, the bees just dry it into honey, which is generally about 16% water.
And they know exactly when it's right?
They do. It's amazing. I don't know, but they know when it's honey, and then they'll cap it off with beeswax that they make in order to preserve it. And that's their food source. That's why bees make honey, is to have it to feed their young and also to feed themselves in the winter when there is no nectar.
But when you take honey from the hive, you're taking away their food.
I am, but I'm taking away their extra supply of food. Bees need just a certain amount to get them through the winter. Like in Connecticut, where my bees are, they need about 60 pounds of honey. So anything else that they make beyond that is surplus that I can take. I don't feel bad about it.
You know, I think about, you see terms on a bottle, clover honey. But how can you be sure that a bee is going to one flower?
Well, I spent a lot of time with a honey maker and a beekeeper in Wewahitchka, Florida, which is the Florida Panhandle, which is the only place in the world where the tupelo tree grows in any quantity. Mm-hmm. And what this tupelo farmer did, or does every day, his name's Don Smiley, is he trucks thousands of beehives to the swamps where the tupelo trees live. And when those trees flower, there's almost nothing else for the bees to forage on. And the bees love the tupelo nectar, so they'll just gorge themselves on tupelo nectar, and that's how you get tupelo honey.
So you would just take your bees to, if you want to have rose honey, you'd take them to the rose bushes.
Exactly. And you'd make it so that they were sort of an exclusivity of nectar.
I wonder, I'm thinking about, you know, wine experts can taste a wine, and some of them can tell you where it came from and who made it. Does that happen with honeys too?
Absolutely. That's something that fascinated me as I did research. I've just been doing this for 6 or 7 years, and I'm still really a rookie. But these guys who have been in the business for years, they're like sommeliers. They can taste a honey and tell you which flowers contributed to the flavors. It's amazing.
Helen, can anybody keep bees in their backyard? I mean, how much space do you actually need?
Well, one thing it's really fun to do is go to a farmer's market in Manhattan and see all of the Manhattan honey that's produced. I mean, there are hundreds of beekeepers keeping bees on their rooftops. So it doesn't take very much space at all. Bees will go up to 2 miles from the hive in search of nectar. So
that's amazing.
You know, yeah. Give them a little patch in your backyard and they'll be able to find what they need to make the honey and support the colony.
Right. Hey, Holly Bishop, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Holly Bishop is author of Robbing the Bees, The Biography of Honey. Now you can find Holly's recipe for frozen berry striped pops on the website, splendidtable.org. Want to get a quick business loan from your bank? Tell your banker that you're going to start a water business, as in bottling and selling H2O. The New York Times reported that in 2004, we Americans spent $9 billion on bottled water. Now, we are talking water, not wine, not beer, not green tea, but water. The stuff that comes from the tap, free. Well, New York Times journalist Julia Moskin took a look at this curious state of affairs in her article, Must Be Something in the Water. Julia, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
You know, what I kept thinking as I read this piece was, we live in the United States of America. We have some of the safest tap water in the world. Why are we spending this kind of money?
Well, that is a very complicated question. Really, the most amazing thing about that $9 billion figure is that it is really from nothing before about 1977, which is when Perrier mineral water started to be imported into the United States and had a huge splashy ad campaign with Orson Welles that was very popular. Before that, people mostly bought distilled water when they needed water to put in their steam irons.
Right.
And it's really grown just from there to this notion that you need to have the purest water, that tap water is somehow impure, which is particularly interesting considering how many more billions of dollars American municipalities have spent to establish safe drinking water. You talked about getting a business loan. One of the most successful small business launches and subsequent acquisitions by Starbucks has been of a company called Ethos Water, which was started in someone's garage with this idea of water for water. And Starbucks gives 5 cents of each bottle of Ethos Water that it sells to water-based charities, trying to make a kind of circle by which people in the developed world who can afford bottled water can help people in the third world get to the point where we are of not having to even drink our own municipal water. It's kind of ironic.
So people who really don't have pure drinking water available to them.
Yes.
But what is in the bottles that we're buying? I mean, is this different water, really?
Well, there are a lot of labeling issues. The FDA does regulate very, very stringently between spring water, well water, artesian water, mineral water. About 40% of the bottled water that we drink is actually simply purified municipal tap water. And some municipalities are starting to resist the sort of taking of spring water and tap water in, you know, billions and billions of gallons that private companies are then bottling. There have been lawsuits in Michigan and in Virginia against the Poland Spring and Perrier companies.
You're saying that when I pay my $2 for my bottle of water, it could be coming from a tap somewhere in the United States?
Absolutely. They use various processes, reverse osmosis, desalinization. There are a lot of amazing jargon words that are thrown around, most of which, according to nutritionists at least, are pretty much meaningless.
Does all of this process actually change the taste of the water?
It absolutely does. We did a blind tasting of the dining section at the New York Times, and we brought in one ringer who was a chef, and we were fascinated. You know, most of us assumed, as journalists tend to look at the world with a jaundiced eye that they would all be the same, but in fact they were very different. The natural mineral waters, something like an Evian or a Volvic, had a definitely more what you would call a flat taste, more chalky, and you could really feel the minerals of the calcium on the tongue. Then the municipal waters tend to be much crisper. They have had a lot of the minerals removed, and often also we felt that we could taste the plastic bottles. Much to our surprise, the clear winner of that tasting, which was blind, is a water made by the Coca-Cola company from municipal tap water called Dasani, to which they add sulfates and phosphates in minuscule amounts in order to create a specific flavor profile. Dasani in the United States is different from Dasani in France and Dasani in the UK. The goal is to tailor it to what people are used to. And fundamentally, and most thirst research does show, is that you're most likely to reach for something that tastes like what you're used to.
Backlash to all of this. You talk about a Dutch project that I just thought was very funny and interesting.
This is a brilliant notion. Even the name of it is funny because it plays on the French word for water, which is eau. And this nonprofit foundation is called the No Foundation. And what you buy for $2 in the Netherlands is an empty blue bottle, which you then fill from your tap. And something like half of the money, or at least a dollar, goes to the water charities. There's a lot of objection to bottled water. Water is an extremely heavy product. And to get Fiji water in a container ship to the United States uses fossil fuels at a level that people feel is problematic. There's also a huge amount of byproduct because of the plastic bottles, which have become a huge problem, especially in California. Only about 10% of them actually go to recycling centers, and about 90% of them, according to this study by the state of California, end up as landfill. And that is really essentially, as far as nutritionists are concerned, the only advantage of bottled water is that you can take it with you. However, there is also a backlash against this whole American obsession with hydration, and you have to drink 8 glasses of water a day or 12 glasses of water a day. And a lot of people feel that that's really excessive.
Interesting. Hey, Julia, thank you.
You're so welcome.
Julia Moskin is a reporter for the New York Times. Her piece on bottled water, It Must Be Something in the Water, appeared in the February 15th, 2006 issue of the paper. Gas and a free day. Now we are talking the makings of major food forays. All we need is some inside information so we don't waste a drop or a moment. Well, Seattle is base camp this week. Our insider is Seattle's wise woman when it comes to food scenes and culinary pleasures, Xiao Qing Chow. She's food editor of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Xiao Qing, welcome.
Thank you.
So let's say I have a free day. I'm in Seattle. I've got one tank of gas. Where should I go?
Well, there's so many choices, but I think around this time of year, I'm always thinking about the Skagit Valley. It's one of my favorite places to go because it's so lush and beautiful. And you know, talk about agriculture. They grow potatoes and berries and anything you can imagine. And I just love driving up there and stopping at all the little stands to pick up some berries. And the other favorite place that I like to stop is at the Rexville Grocery. It's an old-time gas station. They also sell a lot of different types of goods and a lot of locally made jams and condiments and local wines.
Oh, this sounds great.
It's absolutely fabulous. And my absolute favorite thing there is a sandwich that they make at the cafe called the Bev Special. And basically it's homemade bread, tomatoes grown in the area, lettuce, turkey, and lingonberry preserves. Yes, because the area is known for growing lingonberries as well, one particular farm. And I just love that sandwich. You can just belly up to the bar, order it, get some chips, even some oysters on the half shell.
Oh, this place has everything.
It has everything. And if you're lucky, it's the hangout of Tom Robbins. You know, maybe he'll sign your book or something while you're there.
Okay, so that's a valley, and it sounds lovely. I keep thinking you have all of those islands They have given me more pleasure. Is there an island we can get to easily on a tank of gas?
Well, one of the easiest islands to get to is Whidbey. And it just takes about a half-hour drive north of Seattle, and then you hop on a ferry. It's a 20-minute ride. Mm. And the island itself is sort of long and squiggly, like a puzzle piece. And you can go, you basically start on the south end of the island at the Clinton ferry dock, and then you drive a couple miles, and you get to a little town called Langley. And there's great places to hang out in Langley. There's lots of art galleries. You can do a little shopping, some boutiques, things like that. But the star of Langley is the Inn at Langley, beautiful little boutique inn owned by the former mayor of Seattle. And they have this fabulous restaurant there. Chef Matt Costello is the guy in charge. Mm-hmm. And basically, you can get a six-course meal for $80, and everything is in season, as local as can be. And it's an open kitchen, so you get to watch him cook. And they have the most incredible wine cellar as well, with lots of Washington wine. So you can have a really regional feast. And then you drive a little bit further north, and you get to Green Bank Farm. Now, Green Bank Farm was once the largest loganberry farm in the United States. It is no longer, but it's the farm itself has kind of become a community center. They have farmers market there on Sundays, a wine shop, antiques cafe, and it's the home of Whidbey pies. So you have to stop there at the cafe to get a piece of pie, and if you're lucky, you'll get a piece of loganberry pie made. They're all homemade by this woman named Jan Gunn. So it's just really special. And at the end of July, there is the annual Loganberry Festival. So be sure if you're in the area around that time to stop by, because it's wonderful. No, it's really great. The third place on Whidbey Island is Coopville, which is the home of Penn Cove Shellfish. And they grow the best mussels in the world, the native Penn Cove mussel.
I love these. You know, not making any kind of great claim, just the best mussels in the world.
Well, it's also the oldest commercial mussel farm in the country. So they ship all over the world, and you can order online and have these mussels shipped to your home. But you can also go visit the farm area and actually see the rafts where they grow these long ropes of mussels. And if you are lucky, you can catch the harvest, and it's pretty interesting to watch. And if you want to eat them right there, well, you have to go to the Oyster Catcher, which is this lovely little restaurant in Coopville, and they just do everything that you can imagine with mussels and a few other things.
Oh,
so that's
good.
That's Whidbey. It's absolutely great.
Okay. Have you got a third one up your sleeve?
Well, in Seattle, we're lucky to have Woodinville Wine Country. Now, it's only a half hour outside of the city, and there are about 26 wineries or so that are represented, and there are also a lot of places where you can eat, too. After you've toured some of these wineries, you can stop by the Purple Cafe and Wine Bar, where they offer 75 wines by the glass.
Holy cow. So, and the idea that that's 30 minutes out of town.
It's not very far at all. It's a great place to go hang out without having to travel all the way to the other side of the state, to Walla Walla, where the other wine country is for Washington.
And the wines aren't bad.
Oh, the wines are fabulous. I mean, now Washington is second to California as far as production amount. So we're pretty proud of our wines here. It's pretty incredible.
Well, Chao-Ching, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure, Lynn.
Chao-Ching Chow is food editor of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer newspaper. Now, you can find her tank of gas picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, this one comes from Holly Bishop's book, Robbing the Bees. Here's the question. What's the connection between bees and warfare? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's the link between bees and warfare? Well, honey and bees have been weapons as recently as Vietnam and as long ago as ancient Greece. Now, ancient fighters had their bees make honey from toxic plants like oleander or azalea. The honey was toxic, so you'd trick your enemy into eating it and you'd cripple his army with sickness or even death. It was documented over and over again. Now, angering hives into stinging fests was another technique. Now, this didn't disappear with modern weapons. Guerrilla fighters in Vietnam used beehives against American troops. Now, one of the guerrillas explained how they did it. They studied local hives, and they saw that the bees always had four sentries on duty. Now, if they were disturbed, they'd call out the entire hive to attack. So the guerrillas set up the hives in trees on the road to their village. Each had a tripwire system that would tear at the hive. The wires were tripped by American troops, the bees attacked, and the soldiers couldn't fight back. This is one of the many tales from Holly Bishop's book, Robbing the Bees. It's time for your calls, brought to you by Hefty One-Zip Bags. Pick up that phone. The number is 800-537-5252. Okay, let's get to our first caller. It's Renee from Columbus. Hey, Renee, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Well, I would love to talk about baking with yeast. My husband and I like to experiment with making our own pizzas, and we make all different kinds, everything from Thai to Hawaiian to margarita pizzas. And but what we've been doing, what I've been doing lately is making my own pizza dough.
Right.
But I've been having problems with the dough sometimes not rising. And, you know, of course, the recipes say sometimes to put the dough in a warm place.
Right.
I can't seem to find a place in my house that's warmer than the others. You know, I remember when I was little, my mom would bake bread. She'd put it on top of the fridge with a towel on top of it.
Yeah, exactly. So is it that the dough isn't rising at all, or is it just that it's rising very slowly?
It's not rising at all. I buy often the quick-rise yeast,
yeah,
and it's not rising at all.
Okay, here's the thing about the yeast. First of all, you with quick-rise yeast, you generally want to mix it in with the flour and with the ingredients.
Okay.
But you need to have, if I'm remembering, and this should be on the package, that you need to have them at room temperature. You don't want anything stone cold.
Okay.
And if you use the traditional yeast, which I'm more familiar with, which is, you know, the regular dried yeast, but it's not quick rise, the trick there is you always proof it, and that is that you put you put the yeast in a little bit of warm water. Now, this is where you want an instant reading thermometer.
Okay.
You really should have one anyway in the kitchen.
Okay.
Because it's the way you can tell if meat's done, you know, a ton of other things.
Mm-hmm.
But you want the water somewhere between, somewhere around 90 degrees. And you add a pinch of sugar, and you'll see in about 5 minutes that yeast will bubble.
Okay.
And you will see that the yeast is alive and well. If with the quick rise yeast, you want it to go into the dry ingredients. And let me ask you something. What's the proportion of flour to liquid in the recipe you're using?
Well, it's 3 cups of flour.
Right.
And I just make it in the food processor.
Right.
Add lukewarm water until it becomes, you know, pretty doughy and forms a ball. So I don't even really measure
it. You don't measure it. Right. Is it getting very warm in the food processor? Because, you know, yeast dies over a certain temperature, somewhere around 130, but it's usually safe to say 120.
Okay.
You may be killing off the yeast because the friction in the food processor, if you let it go, really warms up the dough.
Okay.
So a couple of things to think about. First of all, if you're using the food processor, I'd do the opposite. I'd start with cool ingredients.
Okay.
Not stone cold, but cool. I'd use cool water, for instance. Don't make the dough too heavy.
because that too is going to weigh it down and make it harder for it to rise. Most yeast pièce de doughs, you want them to be just a little bit sticky, just a little.
Okay.
And you want to, and you know, if you really want to do this right, yes, let the food processor do some of the kneading for you, but knead it a bit yourself too to make sure it's really stretchy.
Okay.
And the last thing is that from a quality or flavor point of view, okay, the slower you rise dough, the more flavor you get out of it. Because of the way the flour and the, you know, the flour or the material in the flour reacts.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things you may want to consider is, instead of trying to make it fast, there's an old saying, you don't build your life around your dough, you build your dough around your life.
Mm-hmm.
And let me give you an example. You could take your same recipe, use the usual yeast and not the fast rise. Okay.
Okay.
Take the 5 minutes to make sure the yeast is alive and well. And there's always a date on the package, too. Just make sure it's within that date. Mix up the thing in the food processor using cool water. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And do this at night and stick it in the fridge overnight.
Okay.
Before you leave for work in the morning, just take it out and put it on a counter. Oh, and the other thing, cover it, put it in a really deep bowl so that if it rises to 3 times its height, you know, it's not going to hit the top of the bowl.
Okay.
Cover the bowl with plastic wrap because you need the humidity.
Okay.
You know, some people let dough rise just uncovered, and you get this sort of hard crust on it.
Yes, that's happened to me before, too.
Yeah, just put some plastic wrap over it. Or you can put it loosely over it, and if the dough rises up, it just pushes up against it. Anyway, the idea is leave it out on the counter all day.
Okay.
And then at night, just, you know, spread it out, make your pizza.
Okay.
I think you'll have an even better flavor to your dough, and you won't. Quick rising yeast can be a little fiddly, whereas the regular, you know, dried yeast in the package is less fiddly.
Okay.
See what you think.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
And I wanted to tell you that I listen to podcasts of your show while I'm running after work. So well, I just want to let you know I'm burning calories while I'm listening to your show.
Applause is happening now in the control room.
Well, but usually by the time I finish my run, I've completely changed my mind about what I want to make for dinner. But you make everything sound just delightful.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. I'll think of you running.
All right.
I always think I should have a treadmill here in the studio. Hey, Renee, thank you.
Thanks, Lynn.
Bye.
Bye.
Yeah, you know, this whole business about making bread is really interesting because it's incredibly simple. Flour, water, yeast, and salt. And yet, books have been written on it. It gets tricky. Just remember, keep the temperature below about 120 and you'll probably be fine. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see, who is up? We have got Carol calling from Eagle Harbor, Michigan. Carol, welcome. What do you want to talk about?
Well, good afternoon. Our son and his lovely fiance met in Paris when she was visiting there on a bit of a student exchange 2 years ago, and my son was working there as a bicycle tour guide. They met under the Eiffel Tower, so it's highly romantic. But we wanted to do sort of a French menu for the rehearsal dinner. We're having about 60 to 65 guests. We are not doing the cooking. We are having it at a wonderful supper club, which has great family history because my parents actually had their rehearsal dinner there in 1950.
Huh.
So the chef is a young gentleman who is eager to try anything. So I asked about a French menu, summer wedding, and we're talking about some ideas, but I was interested to see what you might have to offer.
Well, let me think. A summer wedding. Well, first of all, I think at this time of year, and you want to keep things very fresh and very light. And I think I would lean toward poultry. I would lean toward seafood. It's salmon season. And one thing that would be glorious, whether you serve it as a first course or... Now, are you doing a sit-down dinner?
We are.
Okay. I'm just thinking of how beautiful a whole salmon looks. A poached or slow roasted salmon that maybe has been stuffed with tarragon and slices of lemon, and you can even get green garlic now, you know, the new garlic, and slice that and put it in the cavity, and then it could be brought out just on a whole bed of fresh herbs, you know, fresh thyme and bouquets of oregano and that kind of thing, and just set out on that, and if he has slow roasted it skin on. And he can even put a garland of something like, you know, weave big branches of thyme with daisies. And then they could go back into the kitchen and it could be sectioned out and served in very small portions. Again, cold
or at room temperature. And the idea is it might be a first course, and he could do kind of a salmon cream with it where you can, I'm just remembering there was a wonderful chef in Paris named Joël Robuchon who you would take smoked salmon and you would puree it, and you want to put into that a lot of fresh lemon, a little bit of Tabasco, and then salt and pepper, and you fold in whipped cream and you fold in lots of snipped fresh chives. And you don't want a lot of that. You want a slice of this salmon, maybe some of that garnish of all those beautiful fresh herbs, and maybe a few flowers. And then you want just a little mound of that cream that as you take it on your fork, you just dip it into that cream mixture. But you've got that pale pinkish, and you've got salmon on salmon. You've got smoked, a hint of the smoked salmon, and then you've got the fresh salmon. And a lot of lemon on that fresh salmon. So I think that would be a nice first course. And then maybe you could do, I'm just thinking, because I keep thinking south of France, you know, the heat. And not that that's the only place you can draw from, obviously, but, you know, I would love to see beautiful roast chickens where everybody can make a choice, you know, if they want the breast or do they want the leg and thigh. But what you could do with the chickens is you could stuff fresh herbs under the skin.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
And you could complement that with garlic and with olive oil and a little wine. And you just stuff that under the skin, and the chef would do that the night before. And then he'd do a real proper roast chicken where you'd have a really crisp skin. And he would have, in the cavity, put, again, chunks of lemon with lots of garlic. And then that could be served, and with baste it with wine as it cooks, so take some of those pan juices. And then on the side, what would be great would be take all the great summer vegetables and do a fast stir fry of them, but do it with a bit of white wine, with a bit of, you know, again, I keep going back to the fresh herbs because it's so important at this time of year. I would use exclusively basil.
Okay.
And you could use, now this could be things like green beans, sugar snap peas, little new potatoes, thin, thin slices of baby carrots, you know, the farmer's market. Have him go to, you know, cash in on what's coming in locally.
Sure.
And that you have this beautiful array, really, of these wonderful vegetables.
Good idea.
Yeah. And then you could have a green salad, and you could dress that with a hazelnut oil, which would be lovely, or better yet, even a walnut oil, because some people have an allergy to hazelnuts.
Oh, okay.
And good vinegar. And you may want to throw some violets into that salad.
Well, no, doesn't that sound lovely?
Well, violets are just pretty, and they taste delicious. Nobody eats violets these days. And then dessert could be something like a raspberry strawberry tart. And I just think that would be a gorgeous way to end the meal. Oh, and of course, you've got to have a big plate of cheeses before that.
What excellent ideas. My husband and I are currently reading Julia Child's book that just came out,
Oh,
My Life
yes,
in
yeah,
France.
Yes, exactly. Perfect thing to be reading.
Exactly.
Hey, congratulations to the couple and to you.
Thank you so very much for your wonderful ideas.
You're welcome. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. You know, we talk to chefs on the show. We talk to writers, to food scientists. But what about eaters, as in professional eaters? Now, the man who holds the 9th spot on the top eaters in the world list. Now, this is published by the IFCE, the International Federation of Competitive Eating. Well, his name is Eric Badlands Booker, and he's calling in from Coney Island. Hey, Eric, or should I say Badlands, welcome.
Hey, thanks a lot, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
You hold championships. I went up on your website and then up onto the website for the International Federation of Competitive Eating.
Uh-huh.
You are a champ with cannolis, corned beef, apple dumplings, matzo balls. How did you get into this?
How did I get into this? Well, I've been doing this sport for 9 years. And it was just a sign with Uncle Sam, a fork in his hand, and he said, I want you to enter the Nathan's Hot Dog Contest. So I said, sign me up. You know, no training, no nothing, just eating them like I'm at a barbecue. I ate 17 hot dogs and buns in 12 minutes. And earned a spot at Coney Island, got a year supply of hot dogs, which is 480 links at once.
Oh, my goodness.
And I got a nice trophy about 2 feet tall. I mean, ever since then, I just got hooked on, you know, sport competitive eating. I've stepped up my game, and, you know, the rest is history, I guess.
So do you train?
Yeah, there is a certain amount of training that I do to get to where I'm at. You know, basically, you need four things in order to do well at this sport. You need good stomach capacity.
Right.
You need good eating strategies. You need a bit of stamina. I mean, you don't have to be like Carl Lewis or Bruce Jenner, but, you know, just, you know, go to the gym three times a week.
Right.
And most important, you need a strong, focused mind. You need to know why you're there at the table, what's your purpose. You got to be hungry and focused.
Okay. Now, what's your day job?
I work as a New York City subway conductor.
So, hey, if I get on the right train, I can meet you.
Oh, yeah. I work Monday through Friday from 6 to 10. I'm on the train. You know, if you're going to that Mets game
right.
or U.S. Open tennis, just hop on the number 7 train. I'll probably be taking you there.
Now, I understand you are also a musician. Tell me about this.
Yes. I've been doing hip-hop music for as long as I can remember, ever since I was a kid. I put it to the side for a little while to pursue the competitive eating sport. And then there was this contest called the Philadelphia Wing Bowl that came up. And basically we did a song called The IFOC Is Here. And we're coming to take the crown, you know what I'm saying? And we're going to go and just kick the Philly Eaters' butt. So one song, you know, led to another. And then it led to an album called Hungry and Focused, which I put out in 2004.
I love it. And that's your theme, right? You've got to be hungry and you've got to be focused.
Yes, hungry and focused is the motto.
Badlands, we wish you luck.
Oh, thank you.
And thanks so much for calling in.
Oh, thanks for having me. I wouldn't have missed it for the world.
You take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Goodbye. Put a hurting on the food establishment. Owner sees me and the man is adamant to put up his clothes sign in a hurry. They call his supply trust kind of early. And I know I'm about to be banned when he's like, don't come back, understand? You eat like a sumo, can't beat your man. Around the fifth play, he realized who I am. They call me Badlands Booker. Super fly like Ron O'Neill. That's competitive eating champion Eric Badlands Booker on his CD called Hungry and Focused. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Philip W. Haberman. A gourmet is just a glutton with brains. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. And you can download our weekly podcast, Kitchen Questions. Sign up for both online, splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is brought to you in part by Hefty, maker of the Hefty OneZip, a food storage bag designed so that the rest of the family can close it. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week, and be sure to join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. American Public Media.